by Tanya. So I'm going to share my screen for just a second and I'll kick us off and then we'll get right into it. So this is our third community session, workshop, or whatever we want to call it, forum, talking about the intersection between org design and business agility. So I know that we have some, yeah, so here we go. So org design and business agility, and that's us in the middle, people who are interested in both of those things and where they intersect. And some of you may have not been here before, so I just want to share sort of our model and our theory on how this might work. So the idea was we kind of establish a purpose of us joining together of the compound impact between business agility and org design and how we can, you know, be generative by joining together. So we did that. And then we created some, I'll just open the whole slide here. We did a bunch of activities around sharing and learning. So we did org design 101, business agility 101, real quick stuff. And we created some, we defined some boundaries, we created respect, we shared knowledge. And this is, and we did some Mythbusters last month. And this is actually our first time moving then from share and learn into cross-pollination. So I'm very excited about that. Pollination. Okay, I spelled it right. So that's where we are now, where we can actually, now that we've established some foundation, we can actually create together. And then really the ultimate goal is eventually to create new possibilities and have new thinking come out of this group once we start to understand it. So this is sort of the brainstorming stage. I see there's some things in the chat. Do I need to look at this? Okay. Yeah. So we do want things in house space so that we can keep the conversation going even after this hour is over. So that's sort of our model. That's where we are in the journey of these two communities and hope to continue this group collaborating together. So we're going to do something fun today. We're going to experiment with this. So I appreciate your patience ahead of time. But what we'd like to do is rather than have breakouts or discussions, we're going to do a fishbowl. And the idea of the fishbowl here, if you may have done them in person, you may have done them virtually. I haven't done them virtually, but we're going to try it, is that we'll have four people spotlighted in the center having a discussion. And then those people observing on the outside will turn off your camera and you'll mute. And if you're ready and you'd like to join the fishbowl and join the discussion, you'll raise your hand, Tanya will move you in and somebody will move out. So we'll always have people rotating basically into that center of the fishbowl to join the discussion. That's the idea of a fishbowl. So when you're in the fishbowl, just to be clear, you're in the fishbowl, you'll have your hand raised and there's a little picture here at the bottom of how to raise your hand in Zoom if you haven't done that. You can play with it right now if you want. So you'll raise your hand, Tanya will spotlight you and you'll turn and unmute you. Right, Tanya? You'll unmute them?
I can only ask to unmute you.
Oh, okay. So you'll unmute yourself.
If you don't know how to do it yourself.
So when you're spotlighted, you'll turn on your camera and unmute and you'll move into the center of the fishbowl. Someone will move out. So we'll always have four people having a discussion at any given time. While you're in the fishbowl, you'll keep your hand up the whole time until you're ready to leave the fishbowl. Then you'll lower your hand. That's how Tanya will know.
That's your virtual hand. You don't have to sit with your hand open while you're talking.
Well, Craig does, preferably with the one hand that's immobile. Craig is in a sling. Okay. And so what we're thinking is it's probably about 15 minutes per topic, but we don't know if that's true or not. So if it peters out earlier, we'll end it. If it wants to go beyond it, we'll take a poll and say, hey, do we want to keep talking about this or do we want to move on? So that's the logistics of the fishbowl. And I'll talk about the topics in just a second, but does anyone have a question on the logistics of the fishbowl? Would anyone like to do a cross your finger emoji for the fishbowl? All right. Well, I appreciate your patience on that. Oh, did I have another slide here? Where is it? Oh, maybe I didn't have a slide. Oh, I forgot to do a slide on the topics. So we have, well, you're going to see them in the poll. So we have six topics from the fishbowl, five that we came up with and one that was entered into the house space. So what we're going to do is we're going to put up a poll. So you'll see the topics. And if you can vote on which you're most interested in, we'll work through the challenges and see how far we get in the time that in the hour that we have with the challenges that we're talking about. So what we'd like to talk about with each of these, just so that you know, so you'll see them up on your screen, competing priorities across silos. So what we're going to have is a discussion about, well, how do you handle and solve for that business challenge in org design? And how do you solve for it in business agility? Maybe they're different, maybe they're the same. I guess we're going to find out. But just vote for one of them that you think is most interesting, and then we'll know where to begin.
All right, we have some input getting started, so.
Iris, I love that you say what fun. I think it's fun too.
Oh, it is a great spread. So good job on coming up with some topics and possibilities here.
Do I not see the answer until
I haven't launched it yet. So I've got 85% of you have participated. So I'm going to go ahead and share that now.
Whoop. Oh, yeah. Great. All right. So I guess competing priorities is by the slim margin, the winner. And then Tanya, are you making a note? Okay, you are. So we know where to start. And then we'll go to the scale and remain nimble. And then we'll have a tie for third place here.
So maybe we just kind of tying down try to get those last two that tied in. Okay. I have made note of which ones were the first one. And so I'm going to do some light facilitation to kind of get things launched and going. So we did have some volunteers who thought that they would be the ones to step up and be our first four in the fishbowl. So I'm going to go ahead and spotlight those first volunteers.
And we'll raise our hands just to model the good behavior here. And so that we can take our hand down when it's time to leave.
All right, and then I'm going to set a bit of a timer and we will kind of monitor the flow of the conversation. And if we start getting to where we feel like we wouldn't have time to jump into some of the other topics, then I'll kind of interject. But other words, I'm going to let you all start with, for our agile folks, where would your starting point be with competing priorities across silos?
Then I'll let you start. You're muted though.
The slogan of 2021 and 2020 continues, you're on mute. All right, so let's get the person who it's 5 o'clock in the morning to kick us off. That sounds like a clever idea. Slight facetiousness at this hour. So competing across silos. Where am I going to begin? From a business agility standpoint, silos are generally, you ask any agile coach what they want to do with a transformation, a large number of them are going to say they want to break down the silos. Now, one of the things that try and talk about when we talk about like a business level transformation or a business agility transformation is that you can't actually break down silos. Humans form silos very naturally, us versus them, red team versus blue team. I'd have no idea about American football teams, but like Collingwood versus Essendon here in Australia, it's like you're going to get silos forming in organizations. But what's important is that those silos are designed in such a way that the flow of value is constructive, not destructive. So in a traditional functional hierarchy, where you've got a dev team, then a test team, and a deployment ops team in a tech space, then what you're going to create is this scenario where the flow of value keeps hitting a wall. And so every team's got their own queue, their own backlog, their own priorities, their own definitions of what's important. And that's just the rules of the organization are designed to create these barriers. Now, when we're talking about competing priorities, part of that has to come down to what do we actually mean by silo, and how can we define those silos in a way that allows for that smooth transition of that smooth transition of value. I'll let someone else talk and sort of build on this a little bit. We can go bigger and look at like huge, like business units as well from a silo perspective, but starting small, it's about redesigning the silos themselves.
No, I can jump on that too. Unless you wanted to go, Jardina.
I was going to round it out from a business agility perspective, but I'll be quick, Teresa.
Please.
And then I want to hand it to the org design piece. So just kind of rounding out from what Evan said, I'd like to just kind of highlight a few practices that we use in Agile or business agility that would be that sort of pinpoint what Evan was saying. And Evan, sorry for putting you on the spot. So one of the big things for agility that you'll hear a lot is cross-functional teams. So having teams that are cross-silo, but the goal, as Evan said, is really to reduce that latency that you get from the handoff, from that throwing it over the wall. So from an org design perspective, it's not always cross-functional, but it's cross-functional enough that you're doing that flow that Evan said. The other huge thing, and I saw in the chat, someone alluded to the leadership piece, is creating shared goals. So if you have conflicting goals across organizations where your compliance organization is designed to mitigate or to minimize risk and your innovation organization is designed to get products out the door fast, if you don't have a shared goal, you're always going to be creating silos with conflicting priorities. So a lot of the work that we do with OKRs, for example, creates those shared goals. So those are just some practices that we use to try and break down those silos, even though we don't break down silos, Evan.
Teresa, go ahead. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Teresa, feel free.
Sure. So when I'm looking at that, when I hear things like breaking down the silos, I mean, to your point, Evan, the silos are there for a purpose, right? So they do have that. They have a focus execution arm. And what I'm looking at, because I'm dealing with a couple of these like right now, is to pull up their perspective a little higher to see their touch point in the value chain. When I say that, like the workflow, just as you were touching on, Jardina, about how is the work flowing through? Let's break this down into more tactical bites. Like, what is it inefficient? Where are the aspects that are inefficient? We don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? It's like, where are we having redundancy, or where are we having slowdowns, and why is that? So I like to have the leadership of each group take a look at their part in the flow, in the workflow, that value, the value chain there, and have them pinpoint where those intersections are taking place, just to make it more approachable and not so big. That's the tactics I've been taking lately, and it seems to be able to get them fixed a little bit better on a clear path, on a scheduled path. So that's my two cents.
Perfect. The way that I would also look at this too is, any organization, right, has silos. And so what I look at it from an org design perspective is saying, okay, what are those integrating networks? How is the integration going across? And that those V teams or whatever you call them aren't going to do this on their own. So you have to design the collaboration points. What are those connection points that you're going to have between the silos, whether it's a meeting, a forum, a council? What are you doing to really design the collaboration across the silos? And so I love that the agility perspective of looking at the value stream. And it's, you can do this ahead of time, right? And you can plan for that collaboration to occur in order to get that organization to work cross-functionally. So that's another way to look at it as far as how is it that you can create those collaboration points and make them a part of either a process or a governance system that you create to just make sure that you've got that in place.
And I think that's a key point there, Cynthia, is the governance. When I hear issues about silo and competing priorities, to me, that's a clear governance area to focus on. Who has the decision rights? Who has approval? That's why I'm saying if you go into that level and look at it, it typically unearths what's really going on there, and it's usually a governance issue or a back office issue relative to innovating mechanisms, like like they're having to fill out or complete manual systems or multiple back office systems, at least in our environment, in the Boeing environment. Does anybody else have a hand up? Am I supposed to jump out or jump in?
So I was just going to mention from a process point, I've took my hand down. So if somebody wants to raise their hand and join in, I would step down. But I would also remind you, keep your hand up when you're in the fishbowl so that we know when you want to leave the fishbowl.
So I was just going to add to that. There's a great quote by Deming, and I'm going to paraphrase. If you give someone a quantitative target, they will destroy the company in order to achieve it. Jardina mentioned OKRs, which is becoming a very common tool in terms of how work is measured, but changing it from a simple measure of how many widgets are you going to produce this quarter into actually then linking it to the organizational objectives, like creating a common goal, a common why. And if you have those shared goals, to Teresa and Cynthia, your points as well, if you create those shared goals and you create the measures associated with them that are also shared, then it creates it goes a long way to breaking down competing priorities. Allison?
Hi, I would echo lots of what you were just sharing. That's kind of why I raised my hand to join in. But I don't think competing priorities are the problem within the organization. The lack of prioritization and the lack of alignment is the challenge, right? Like, we want people to have their own goals and objectives and the direction that each silo wants to go. But to have alignment around the ultimate purpose of the organization and then driving down to strategic direction for short and long term and being able to align priorities to that for the organization can help determine what are the right priorities. And it's not necessarily I won or you won, it's that this is what's going to drive our organization forward. I also believe very much in the power of pivot players within an organization, people who can see multiple angles and see into multiple silos, even if they're not completely placed in those, to understand how to best use the strengths of all of those silos to drive forward the work and recognize sometimes the things that at higher levels or across the organization you can't see, but the ways that work gets done and organize around those people, because they can really drive the right things across the organization, not just within their silo.
Yeah. That's great.
All right. Well, thank you, Allison. So we have not had another person kind of raise their hand to jump into this group of fish. Oh, Becca, we do. So I'm going to add Becca in and then we'll shift someone else out and then we'll move on to the next.
Yeah, you can take me out. There you go.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily have a I'm curious to maybe hear about or how some folks share about that. All of this sounds great in theory, and it's everything that we know in theory. And in practice, when you're working with a very large organization that has silos within silos within silos, and also, you know, that have, you know, many of these agencies that have strategic plans and they cascade their goals and they talk about transformation and what, you know, how to align around transformation priorities. But in practice, you know, what I'd love to hear some examples, if there are some, about what this looks like in practice in a particularly large organization that has layer upon layer of silos.
So if I can just make, I'll make one comment first, and then Allison, it looked like you were about to say something. Let me start with the negative, and I'll give you a counter example of an organization that tried this and completely stuffed it. One of the design models you will hear for organization, for agile organizations, is the Spotify model, which isn't and there are issues with it. And I won't go into that, but it basically, if it talks about squads and tribes, the intent is to pivot the functional hierarchy 90 degrees. And there's a little bit more to it than that. But anyway, it is a very common pattern that gets applied to large organizations, banks and telcos, as they become agile. The big consulting firms love their Spotify tribes and squads. Now, one organization, and I won't name them because this is a negative example, very, very large telco went through, they got in the big consulting firms, they did a huge organizational transformation. Everyone got put into new tribes, everyone got restructured around this new model. And they went from being able to create value, deploy changes to products in about 6 months, it went up to about 12. And so they didn't break down the wall. They did break down the silos, but the new silos that formed were worse. The handoffs were much, much slower. And so they basically broke the organization and they're still trying to fix it. But what happened was there was a deliberate design towards, we want to optimize for this, right? But what they didn't do, and I'm being very simplistic here, there's obviously a lot of issues underneath the surface, but one of the big things they didn't do was design for what they wanted to sub-optimize for. Because if you're going to optimize for one thing, you're going to sub-optimize for something else. And that's natural. You can't have everything. Well, there are techniques, polarity management and so forth, which allow you to create a yes and rather than a but. But in general, you can't have both. So what this organization did is, without understanding what they were sub-optimizing for, because they didn't even think about it at all, no one had that conversation. It's a tough conversation to have. The whole thing fell apart and it went particularly badly. So this was an example of those silos being created, being broken down, meant to increase collaboration, meant to increase awareness and alignment, but ended up creating something worse.
Jim, Allison, you joined us. Yeah. Like to hop in, or Allison, did you have something you wanted to add?
I'd love to add a little bit, and then Jim, I'm happy to turn it over to you. But Becca, I don't have a clear answer, right? This is hard work, and it takes lots of time and customization and figuring out what's right for the organization. But I do think it is about kind of fundamental alignment on foundational things, like what are you trying to do? What's your purpose? What are your values? What's your vision? And then determining how to actually plan towards your short and long-term work to get to those things, really planning clear measurement and review all at the strategic level. And then lots and lots and lots of change management to get people to align with that and understand why this is going to be valuable for the company and understand their part in it. And that goes for, you know, big units of the organization and individual people and leaders. And so I think the first step has to be alignment at the senior levels, whatever that means, right? That could mean senior of lots and lots of different people at various levels, or it could mean the most executive leaders, but there has to be alignment in what they're trying to do and then translation to that through lots and lots of change management. Jim?
Yeah, to Becca's question about what do large complex organizations, what have they done that's been successful? Three large ones, one financial management, another one a high tech company, and another medical companies. And the question was, how do we break down our silos? And our question was, so what are your, describe your silos? And essentially they came up with three different kinds of silos that were operating. One was a sort of a control silo. These are my people, I control my people do what I'm getting bonus to do, and that's my silo. Another silo was an information silo. And that is that we are rewarded in our company for what we know. So we need to silo information. So we will build departments and teams that compartmentalize information, and they only share it through me as a senior leader. Those are fairly destructive kinds of silos. The other silo is that we're a silo because we must be. We have to separate our retail banking business from our commercial banking business for regulatory reasons. We have to keep our quality and safety completely separate from our engineering and our production because of controls that have to be maintained in place. So the idea is to get to the silo, to what is the silo with the organization, and get them to be clear about that first. And then we went inside the silos and we asked them, what's the most frustrating thing about working here? And they said, the silos. I know people, one fellow from a US automobile manufacturer that was merging with a European automobile manufacturer said, I know a fellow who was suspended for 2 weeks because on his vacation, he went to a European factory to find out how they installed convertible tops without tearing the fabric and without introducing defects into it, and came back, but he did it without permission. So how do you connect the silo problem to the agility problem? It's the bureaucracy and the information sharing. And if I break it down, I would just say it is a maze of boundaries that silos can create, and they can take a lot of different forms, but they result in a culture of compartmentalization as opposed to collaboration and aligned work.
So you added—
if I can real quick, we're at about 20 minutes on this topic. So I just wanna see if we wanna continue, we can do a quick poll and see if the general pulse is to further this explanation or this conversation, or we want to shift into topic number two. So Evan, I'll give you 1 minute to
one thing to keep in mind also is that if we do even table this topic for now, we can continue it on House Space indefinitely. So we don't, it's not the end of it. Go ahead, Evan.
So just very quick, and Jim, that was fantastic. Thank you. One thing that you reminded me, there's a large bank in Singapore, and they've had these sort of issues with SARS and so forth. And they had an innovation function, innovation silo. And they realized that because there was this innovation function who's responsible for innovation, everyone else was like, well, innovation is not our problem. Right? They're the one who's going to do the innovation. We're just going to do what we do. And so the organization had no innovation. It wasn't part of their culture. And so they made an executive decision. It's like, all right, this innovation, we're going to keep an innovation silo. We're going to keep an innovation function. But they are the one team in the organization who is not allowed to innovate. They're responsible for the innovation culture. And to create, to inculcate the importance of innovation and disruption and just experimentation throughout the organization, but they are not allowed to innovate themselves. That's an everybody responsibility. And when they made, and they did this through a combination of measure, like it was communication, like this is the change of responsibility, but also measures. People, individuals will be measured by their innovation or innovative products or techniques or approaches to work. And without a restructure or changing anything, that shifted. Now I seem to be the only one left.
So. All right.
Well, there was one.
We gave this opportunity to
thank you,
shift onto. So Amy, I see your hand is up. And I also put into the chat, our next topic is gonna be how can we scale and still remain nimble? So Amy, were you hoping to chime in on topic number two? Okay, so now we're going to be looking for four volunteers who might like to be the first round of people to share your genius in this discussion. So let's start with Amy and not to leave them all alone in the room here. And Jim, you want in on this second group? So just a quick tip, I am finding I cannot spotlight you until your video is on. So you're welcome to chime in and, you know, be just a voice, but the system isn't letting that feature of spotlight. You got to be all on, all in or not. And then I do see someone had a question here about, will the chat in Zoom be available after the call? And so, yes, I will post it onto ODF's website after the session, and it'll also, I'll transition it from the conversations here in a Zoom into a way to be able to reference it in our house space repository as well. So again, the question for our second round of conversation is, how can we scale and still remain nimble? And Amy, you are our first volunteer, so I'll let you start off the conversation. And if anybody else would like to join in, please just raise your hand.
Yeah, don't leave Jim and I here alone, like by our lonesomes, like here. Feel free to join in. So this is kind of the central big topic of conversation. I don't want to say conflict in our organization right now, because I've just been with the company a little over a year. They're 15 years old, but it's been, I like to say they have big startup energy, right? And so it was very much like move fast and break things. And with a small organization, there was a lot of collaboration, a lot of innovation. That was the focus for a long time, is driving innovation and, you know, getting out front of competitors and things like that. And so as we're trying to scale and get larger, which is necessitated by the level of revenue growth we're trying to sustain, I'm hearing from my executives that they're just really worried about, how do we stay flexible and drive innovation when we're adding in what feels to them like layers of bureaucracy, but is actually, from my perspective and some others in the company, really just like necessary structure that didn't exist before, where, you know, rather than people being kind of thrown in to report to a manager who may or may not really have any connection to their day-to-day work. You know, we're trying to do more functional alignment. We're really trying to look comprehensively at the org design and make sure that we're not creating structural silos, and we're not creating situations where people, you know, are going to be isolated from each other just by, you know, some weird artifact that so-and-so used to report to so-and-so three iterations back, and now they're here and we don't know why. And, you know, and we don't know why that is. Like, we're trying to be intentional. The intentionality seems to feel like breaking down agility to some of my folks. And I'm just interested to see if anybody's faced that same kind of situation and what you did about it.
Don't have the answer to that question. I'm going to let Jim go though. Maybe you can answer that or something else.
Yeah, the one of the things that we fell upon a number of years ago was to discard the organization chart as any form of organization structure. That is a communication and a governance model, possibly derived from command and control when levels were okay to be 16 deep. That just doesn't work for agility. It's necessary, but to separate people managers from team leaders was a practice that we fell upon. It's not something that we intentionally went after and experimented with. It just happened. And what happened there was that the people leader is responsible for talent almost exclusively. Leadership talent, work talent, knowledge, skills, and abilities development for the future. And the other piece of the structure that arose as being dominant was information. And that was the work leader. Work leaders are accountable for delivering the work to the right parts of the organization and enlisting the right talent onto those projects. So therein said, so what if we took Scrum, a Scrum team concept of a of a product owner, and customers of the outputs or the outcomes of Scrum teams, and Scrums of Scrums, and we replicated that. What would be missing? And the only thing we discovered that was missing were the sort of the peripheral utilities like change management, financial controls, and the such that went along with getting the work done and getting the people in the right seats. That's where the information came in. It was someone mentioned, I think it was actually Jordana that mentioned the sort of the culture of one culture here and one culture there, and then crossing over or not crossing over that well, is the acknowledgement that an organization is going to have microcultures. You don't want the most innovative accountants and legal team on the planet. You don't want the most innovative quality control people on the planet. But you need innovation, and you need quality and control, and you need accounting and finance, et cetera, and legal constraints. So someone else mentioned, I think, what we found to be the keys, and that was a very clear purpose for the organization and recruiting, hiring, holding people accountable for knowing how they will help fulfill purpose was the starting point. So ask someone in the organization what the purpose of their organization is. I'll give you one, and I can give you the brand name because it's in a Harvard HBR paper written about the project. Is we asked some people at Nordstrom, what's the purpose of Nordstrom? And they said, I don't know, but I'm here to make sure that every customer gets what they came in to find, whether it's saleable by me at Nordstrom or by someplace else. Give us an example. Well, an old gentleman came in one time and he was asking for tires for his car. And Nordstrom doesn't sell tires. So I called the local, one of the local car dealerships and asked them if they could send somebody over to help this fellow get some tires. Well, he bought two suits. So there's that idea of starting with purpose and then going to values. What values would help us most in fulfilling our purpose? And driving that through the organization starts a cascade of alignment like you can't believe with power. Then vision, both midterm and long-term vision. Does every leader in the organization, regardless of title, know what the vision is for the future of our company, our organization? And do they know how they're there to contribute to it? And are we building the knowledge, skills, and abilities to deliver on that vision? And then someone mentioned OKRs. Do we have the OKRs, and are they cascaded appropriately through the organization so that there are people that are focused on delivering what we need to pay for what we want to be in the future? So I'll pass it off to someone else. I think three or four different people spawned that response.
Perfect. Thank you, Jim. I think I'm gonna answer this from an org design perspective. When I think about scale versus kind of that versus local, the thing that I look at it a couple different ways. One is the level of control from as far as scaling what you want versus the level of integration that you need in the organization. So when you think of level of control, and the ability to govern kind of at a macro level versus the level of integration and agility that you need at that local level. It is the, you know, when you think about making decisions at each of those levels, it's an agreement, right? Where within the organization, what is it that we need to control and handle at that macro level? What can we allow to be flexible at the local level? And it is creating those agreements in the organization as part of your operating model, as you design your structure, you design your operating model, how is it that you're going to control the information, guidelines, governance, and then what can you then allow to happen at the more local level? So those are all design elements that you create as you figure out what it is that, how your organization is going to look and lay out. Diana?
You know, one of the things that I think about when I think about how can we scale and still remain nimble is, to some degree, you can't. I mean, and I want to share a quick graphic here. I just checked to see if I could. We use this when we're talking about teams a lot. The more people that you are trying to get communicating with each other, the more tangled up things get, and the more nodes you have to pay attention to, and all of those, all of that sort of thing. And I'm not going to keep that up there long, but there's a wonderful one that is no longer available anywhere on the internet. The original site has gone down, but it shows a similar version of this shows up on a lot of different blog posts and so on, that goes all the way up to 20. And I think, you know, so building a little bit on what Cynthia said, who actually needs to be interacting with each other, and what are they trying to get done together, and how can we keep that a manageable size? And, you know, one of the things that I think about is the old, I don't know if they're still doing this or not, but the old Gore-Tex that said, we're going to keep our units of a size that can communicate with each other, where people can know each other and know what each other's job is and help each other out in that way, and those kinds of things. So, you know, I, there was a point in my career where I just said, multinationals, bye, I'm not working with you anymore. Because whenever I went there, I could not see a path to success when they were facing this kind of challenge, where they wanted to behave like a small organization, but just keep growing, 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 growing at all costs, and then running into the fact that you, it's magical thinking to think you can have both. And so that's always my role in any change management, is to say, this isn't going to work. Let's find something else that you want. Let's work on that. Because there are immutable truths, like how many people you think you need to have communicating with each other, that are just never going to go away in a human system. And so we need to work with that and not try to pretend it doesn't exist.
So I actually put my hand up to go, why is no one talking about descaling the organization? And then Diana yes, literally said it. So. I will say one other thing. So we're undertaking a piece of research as an organization. One of our research teams is looking at transformation patterns at different scales, at different size organizations. And what we've done is we've sort of broken organizational complexity from a size standpoint, and there's more factors than just complexity. We've actually identified things like 16 different factors. But 5, 15, 50, 150, 500, 1,500, so on and so forth. And the 150 is one of Dunbar's numbers. Technically, he has like things like three different Dunbar's number, depending on the type of tribe, not Spotify tribe, that's forming. But when we look at those different scale points, we actually are seeing, and again, this research is not complete yet, but we're seeing that there are certain patterns that emerge at the very distinct patterns at these scale ranges. And so the organizational architecture and model that works for a 5-person organization will kill a 15-person organization. It needs a different model. And likewise with 50, and likewise with 150, and so on. And so what happens is that as these organizations grow, there has to be a shift in governance, a shift in structure, a shift in support and process. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of governance. I think governance is important. I think agile governance is important, which is based around, like, it understands risk as opposed to thinks that all risk should be mitigated. But at these inflection points or these plateaus, there are like stable organizational states. And if you're designed for that state, it seems to work. But to exactly what Diana was saying, once you get too big, then it just, the bureaucracy is its own worst enemy. And so the successful organizations are those that understand that these are the sizes, and rather than just keep growing and keep adding complexity, we will start to segment and partition and build silos, ironically, in order to keep simplicity and to reduce the complexity, reduce the scale of any operating unit. Federated orgs, yes, Diana, perfect, absolutely. So those seem to be the scale ranges that we're seeing in our research. So yeah, it's tough.
So Jardina, we're approaching the jump into a third topic, or continue further on this one for our time remaining.
I'm just going to take 60 seconds to close it off, and then we can do like an abbreviated next topic. And then we'll keep talking in house space. I'm going to keep saying that. But thank you, Evan. And I just wanted to, so there's a lot of great information here. And by the way, Dunbar was on a podcast with Alan Alda like 2 weeks ago, the real guy. So he really talks about his number. So check that out. It was really interesting. But I just wanted to mention, there's a lot of great nuts and bolts that we've talked about here from a mindset perspective, from an agility perspective. Anyway, we think a lot about how do we, the polarity, right? The polarity between spawn and shed. Organizations, like you said, Evan, we love to spawn. We hate to shed. So the question from a descaling perspective is, where have we built up too much that we can get rid of some of the stuff that's slowing us down? And what I talk to my clients about is, where is our process slowing us down where we can replace it with some kind of trust or connection? And scale through trust instead of scaling through process. Like, where can we replace those things? And to your point, Diana and Evan, you too, like, yeah, it doesn't scale endlessly. It's not infinite, but where can we like get rid of some of that stuff that we have that's no longer serving us, that's holding us back? That's my 60 seconds. So, and Hire is a great example of an organization that's running like a bunch of little like nodes, right? Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well,
question.
Appreciate that. So our last topic, and we've got about 9 minutes and 15 seconds maybe to
give me a few seconds to close too. So I need like 30 seconds.
Okay, so we have 8 minutes to dive into it is going to be execution doesn't meet strategy. Who wants to jump in first on that one? Do we have any volunteers? The other topic, we have a second topic that we could explore if somebody would rather jump in on that one, because there was a two-way tie. Everyone is so busy, but we're not delivering more value. If someone would like to jump in on that one. All right, James, I'm going to ask you to unmute and kick your video on if you can.
Yeah, actually, I want to talk about the first one.
Execution doesn't meet strategy?
Yeah, so what we're finding is people think it's magic that they have a new strategy. Say if they want to get into a new market, you just can't press that button and all of a sudden you have all the talent, all the supply chain issues, all the legal hurdles. So you really need to build capabilities for matching that strategy and align current operations to that new strategy. And those gaps can really be closed by a lot of different techniques outside of the org design or transformation world from the world of business architecture, which builds corporate capabilities. And if you do that as part of that transformation, then you have the greater ability to execute. And that's what we've been finding.
Cool. I will yield the floor to anyone else who wants it, but this is like my favorite topic. So I'll give you 30 seconds. To me, that execution and strategy bridge is the holy grail of all organizations. So I really do focus on that a lot. And for me, the tool I use is OKRs, but you can use whatever tool you want as long as you have a bridge between your strategic goal and your execution activities, and that there's a feedback loop okay, or they're great for this, right? There's a feedback loop of, are we still doing the right activities or the best activities to meet our goals? And what we're seeing, what are we learning from our activities that may debunk our strategy, right? I mean, that's the conversations that we just don't have a practice for in most organizations, that they're not even having the conversation.
Putting into place double loop learning, right?
There you go. Yeah, perfect.
So one of the things I wanted to add was what we saw at the beginning of the pandemic. So back in March 2020, no one's strategic plan from January was active by April. And so this idea of a 3-year strategic plan went very, very, very much out the window. But I want to introduce a concept called emergent strategy or adaptive strategy or strategic agility, whatever you want to call it. But it is an ability for an organization to create implicit feedback loops into strategic plans and very rapid decision cycles. And so there's a couple of things that was happening early on in the pandemic from a strategy standpoint. The first is those organizations that had feedback loops from low in the organization, from the point of connection to the customer, were able to respond faster because they were getting a lot faster feedback and input from the customers from what was happening on the ground. And they could actually feed into, go, hang on a second, our strategic assumptions are no longer valid. Those organizations that had to wait for the market signals and everything else to filter through their data systems into the people who could make decisions took much longer to respond to the pandemic. The other thing to note was around the speed of decisions. So an emergent strategy with those feedback loops in that crisis situation, and this is true in non-crisis situations as well, it was just very obvious at the beginning of the pandemic, you have to make decisions, strategically aligned or strategically transformative decisions very quickly, and you don't have enough information to make a good decision. No one does, because no one knows what the caseload is going to be the next day. We're talking back in March 2020. And so what's happening is that those organizations that could respond to change, who built those feedback loops, were making decisions every day, and those decisions were tied into the decisions made the day before. Other organizations that didn't have those feedback loops built in, they still had to make decisions every single day because you have to, there's no choice. The problem is they were reacting to change rather than responding to change. And so that reactive nature meant that those decisions were sometimes disconnected, often disconnected, and misaligned. And so you're making these two organizations making decisions every single day. One's responding, one's reacting, and the one that's reacting is going to unfortunately jump off a cliff, because that's kind of what happens if you have that series of disconnected strategic decisions.
Evan, so we've got about 3 minutes.
Go ahead, Jordan.
Jump in, Jim, and then Cynthia.
Okay, just a point back to James's point on capabilities. Quite a while ago, I participated in writing the book. There still is, I can't find another one since, called The Capable Company. And the idea was using capabilities as the bridge between strategy and execution. And that is, if you cannot describe all the capabilities that you need and what your current state of those capabilities are before you accept a strategy, you're making a mistake. You're going to slow down. So I put a couple of references out there on the chat. One is a company, Accelair.com. They have built a company around that concept, and they do remarkable work with all sorts of organizations in helping them put capabilities between their strategy and their execution, is building and codifying and assessing capabilities. And the other is the original book, which you'll probably find is outrageously priced on Amazon.com these days because it's no longer in publication. But the concept is very solid, is to think of the organization as a set of capabilities as one view. Go ahead.
Oh, no, Jim and James is perfect because, you know, that is actually also part of the STAR model in organization design, going from strategy, you know, you actually have to identify those capabilities. And the other thing I would say about COVID and capabilities, you guys did, Evan talked about the decision-making capability and, you know, the ability to respond to feedback. The other capability that was challenged was just infrastructure. Right? Were companies ready to go completely virtual? And are their employees, you know, kind of set up that way as well? So companies who found themselves in ready to do that had all of those capabilities and really excelled. And of course we know those that didn't, but I think again, great points on bridging strategy to execution through capabilities. Absolutely. And that's all I had. So, Jardina?
That's super cool. Well, I just want to thank everybody for their input here. This was such a great session. I want to watch it again, actually, because there was so much shared. And we'll share that there's a bunch of great information in the chat. But before you all hop, I just want to say there's one more session for this group, at least planned, and then we can always plan more. But in March, to talk about tools and techniques. But really, I would love it if you all came to the Business Agility Institute conference and then the ODF conference where we can all meet in person. And we will be doing, we'll be swapping post and pre-conference workshops. So there's an ODF conference workshop at the BAI conference and there's a BAI pre-conference workshop at the ODF conference. So you can't go wrong no matter which one you choose, but definitely think about attending either virtually or in person, but it'd be great for us to all meet and have a little chat as this intersection community, whatever you want to call that. So I look forward to seeing you all next month at Tools at Techniques. And thank you so much for all of your input.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Janine. And thank you, Tanya, for facilitating.
Thank you. Great session. Oh, yeah.
Big thanks to Tanya.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for making the fish bowl work.
I think it worked well.
Thought it was super duper fun.
Yeah, you guys did great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Cynthia.
I'll stay on the line for a minute in case anybody has any post-session questions.
Yeah, I have time. I'll hang out too. I'm curious if there's any feedback on the fishbowl format because we were taking a risk there. I think it was fun.
I loved the, this is Steve Davis. I loved the fishbowl format. I've seen it rarely done virtually. And so I really loved how you folks did it today. I actually have a question if I can.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So I just discovered organization design and ODF. I'm formerly a counselor. I got interested in org development and then a colleague from the Gestalt Institute of Cleveland kind of turned me on to organization design. So I just have a general question of kind of what recommendations would you make in terms of kind of resources for learning for someone who's new to org design and kind of trying to learn about it as a field.
I'm going to just real quick, you'll hear this stopping recording message. So